Ever wondered what powers the world of your favorite superheroes? Dive into Understanding Superhero Comic Books, the definitive guide that unravels the mystery. It plunges into the captivating world of spandex, superpowers, and the masterminds who conceive them. Trace the origins and evolution of superhero comics, fueled by influences from Bela Lugosi's enigmatic charm, Errol Flynn's daring exploits, and the early mesmerizing magicians. Witness Batman, Wonder Woman, Captain America, and more as they navigate societal shifts, reflecting our world within their epic tales. Buy Alex Grand's Understanding Superhero Comic Books, available now.
Welcome to Who Was Steve Ditko? This is a panel celebrating and hearing more about the life of this amazing, amazing person and creator. I'm Tyler McPhail. I am your moderator today. Oh, thank you. And that's enough about me. Let's go on to these amazing people, starting with Lenny right over here.
Hi, my name is Lenny Schwartz. How are you all today?
All right.
Oh. Alex Grand. I wrote Understanding Superhero Comic Books and host of Lego Art Spider-Man.
And I am Mark Ditko, Steve Ditko's nephew.
And I am Marcy Single. I am Steve Ditko. Actually, we called him JD or Junior Ditko. He's my first cousin once removed, so he's my mom's first cousin.
And I'm Jackie Estrada, enough said.
Well, welcome you guys. Thank you so much for being here. First off, the first question I have today is, what is your interest in Steve Ditko? I think two people have already told us, but I would love to hear so much more from you guys. So whoever would like to go first.
I'm a playwright and I actually wrote a play about Steve Ditko. I've always loved Steve Ditko, his comics, everything. Love his art. Actually, when we're talking out there, one of the things I really hit on is I really like his writing as well. I love his essays. I love everything he did. His writing was very, in a lot of ways, very influential to me. And I'd always pick up his Kickstarters, everything going on with that. And I've always enjoyed his take on the world. So that's my interest in Steve Ditko.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You know, I love Ditko's creativity. You know, I love his stuff that he did at Marvel, of course, Doctor Strange and Spider-Man, but the world building that he did during those few years on those that made me interested in looking up the stuff he did for Charlton in the 1950s. He pioneered a certain cinematic approach to comics. It was almost like watching a Hitchcock episode, every little short story that he was, you know, storytelling. And he would experiment with different modes of telling comics, different genres, anxiety, neurosis, being able to portray that like no one else. And I think I just got sucked down the Steve Ditko rabbit hole by just looking at his early stuff, and that's my interest.
Well. I have to say probably my primary interest is to give people, I guess, through me and my understanding of him, an opportunity to maybe find out a little bit more about who he actually was as a person. You know, his comic career is well documented and covered by guys like this. So I want to be a conduit to try to relay things that I know about him that I think others and fans and admirers of his might not know and might be interested to know.
And my reason is from what I've read, you know, it's always about the illustrator and, you know, who that Steve Ditko was, but you don't read about the person he was like to our family. You know, what he meant to all of us and the time that he shared with us and what he did for us. And I was a little girl, and I'll tell you, well, when we get to that, I'll tell you a story that is near and dear to my heart about him. And so this is just like kind of like my tribute to him and to thank him for, you know, what he meant to me as a little girl, even though we were relatives. So, and I want to share that with everyone.
Well, I am old enough that I was a fan of Marvel and DC and everything in the mid-60s, and I, over the years, actually had many interactions with Steve in various ways, both through Comic-Con and through work that my husband, Bat and Lash, was involved with, and so I'll be talking about some of those projects and interactions during the panel.
Growing up, and if people have been in other panels that, you know, where I've spoke, you'll kind of hear me say some similar stories. But when I was growing up, I was born in 59. So, I mean, he was my godfather. And, you know, for the first decade-ish, decade and a half of my life, he was just my uncle. You know, the family basically was instructed, and, you know, per what my dad said, is that when my uncle would come into town, that we're not, he's not there on business. You know, he's there for personal reasons and family. So we really didn't know. As kids, we didn't know. But there were comics all around the house, always. And I grew up kind of reading Conga, and was my first comic. So I kind of fell in love with gorillas, and used to kind of fast forward when he would come in town, or when we, let me say this, when we would get together, because I actually thought he lived in Johnstown, because every time we had family gatherings, he was always there, whether it was summer barbecues or Christmas or something. I didn't know he lived in New York. I was, you know, single digit age, and every time the family got together, he was there. Anyway, at one point he was showing my older brother how to draw something, and I said, you know, I was reading Conga at the time. I didn't know who drew it. Didn't know he drew it. So I said, hey, Uncle Steve, can you draw me a gorilla? And he just whips out this gorilla. And I was like, whoa. I was just the five-year-old just blown, like, oh, my God, this gorilla is amazing. And obviously it was very much like Conga. And I thought, wow. So every time I'd see him, I'd ask him to draw me a gorilla. And then I ended up telling him that story when we reconnected in the early 90s, and he ended up drawing me another gorilla and saying, still monkeying around, Mark. So, you know, that's kind of the sort of the side of how I, when I was small, what it was like for me to have him around. And it was just, he was just a relative. He was a relative that had a artistic skill.
Did you keep all of your gorilla drawings?
I do not have those. I have no idea where those are. What did we know? You know? And I only have one comic from that era that I carried forward. And then one other little story where my relationship really changed with him is I was early college days, long hair. I had really short hair, so I said I had long hair. And then short hair, now it's long again. But when I had long hair and I was hippie, you know, bandana, just being a real hippie, I was at the kitchen table and he was sitting there. He came over to the house to visit. And I was just complaining about something, some social situation, some war, something. It was probably mid-70s, and just complaining about something. And he said, so what are you doing about it? And I kind of thought that was just bizarre, like nothing. And then he said, well, you don't have a right to complain about it then. So that was like the first philosophical slap in the face that he ever gave me, and he gave me many. But that was the first one that I was like, whoa, that's deep. and our relationship really just changed. Yeah, everything changed from that point on. And the glue that then tied me to him was philosophical. So
I love that. Thank you for sharing.
So for me, and as Mark had mentioned, when he would come to Johnstown to visit, and he had always taken the train from New York City He would always make sure that he came to visit my grandmother, who was his Aunt Mary, my mom's.
I still don't understand that relationship.
Yeah, well, I'll explain to you later. Yeah. It might take a while. Yeah. So he would always come and visit, and he always made time for family. And as Mark mentioned, you know, it wasn't about work. We didn't know. I mean, because, and I'm younger than Mark, by the way, okay? I'm not going to say how much younger. So I was a little girl, and, you know, when he would come to my parents' house, we knew that he drew. So in little girl terms, we knew that he drew. So I was like this, you know, excited little girl. And I recall vividly, and this was 1975, I'm like, oh, you know, let me find something for him to draw for me. And I remember my parents saying, no, you know, he's busy, he's relaxing. You know, and I ran, like, in the bathroom. My parents had this little soap dish with little soaps in, and I pulled it out, and he sketched it out, and, like, beautiful. You know, I had a doll baby at the time, if I can say, Mrs. Beasley. he drew her for me. Yeah, just different things, but as from a little girl's perspective.
So you had props and stuff you would just set up, and he would just draw them?
He would just draw them, yes. We were all having conversations. He was having conversations with my parents, my grandparents. And yet, he took the time to sketch these things out. And it's like, it was like such a beautiful moment that I, you know, really, I am so grateful and thankful, you know, not for any other reason. They're mine. They're just mine. And that was near and dear to me. But so that was one of the things that I recall. My mom also would say that, and I always tell her, you know, Mom, you need to use a different word in this day and age. But she said the gang would get together at his parents' house every Sunday, the homestead, she called it. And so Mark's dad and my mom are first cousins. And so that group would always hang out at the family, their family house. And she said a lot of times, you know, he was just, you know, sketching. He was doing his thing. So anyhow, that was nice. And then over the years, every single Christmas, he would send my mom a card and handwrite. You know, it was a beautiful thing. So those are the things that are near and dear to us as family. That's how we knew him. Later on in life, we knew, okay, Spider-Man. We're like, whoa, what?
But even then, it wasn't really, you know, someone asked me, well, what was it like when you first found out, like, what he really did? It was like, I don't know. It was just really anticlimactic. It was like, oh, wow. Yeah. It's a relationship. You're right. It was the same, you know. It was just like, oh, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let me take you back to the 1960s. I was in college in San Diego State, and my boyfriend at the time, Davey Estrada, who I married in 68, and we were married for 10 years. We were comics fans and, of course, big Ditko fans. And Mr. A came out, and that was 67. And so we subscribed, and we wrote letters to Steve, and he responded. And Davey still has all of that correspondence. By the way, he's managing editor at Dark Horse Comics, so he's still in the comics biz. So we had a correspondence, lots of letters back and forth. We had some projects that we wanted to do that he was giving us feedback on, kind of books about comics that we wanted to do that we never did. And then I started working on Comic-Con. I'm one of five people who've been to every single San Diego Comic-Con. I started actually, I think 74, I started doing the PR and marketing stuff like that. And then I became the editor of the souvenir book, the program book it was called back then in 77. And I solicited artwork from various artists. And so this is the book from that year with the Alex Nino cover. This is the pinup he sent in for the book. And it says, to San Diego Comic-Con 77, regards Steve Ditko, 77. I still have this artwork. And then I edited the book the next year, and he sent in a piece, which I still have the original artwork of. And it's just, regards San Diego Comic-Con 78 as Ditko. So we had that going back and forth. And then let's jump forward to 1990, and before Comic-Con, the Chicago Comic-Con was at 4th of July weekend, and San Diego was going to be at the end of the month, and I had finished doing the souvenir book that month, and so went to Chicago on a whim. And at a DC party, this guy comes up to me and says, are you Jackie Estrada? I said, yes. Oh, I just want to thank you for including my drawing in this program book this year. It's first time ever. It was a tribute to the Spirit's 50th anniversary, and Will Eisner had been his teacher and everything like that. And we got this conversation and kind of kept running into him at various times, me and my friend and him and his friends. And at one point, Ditko's name came up, and I said, oh yeah, I have 5 pages of original art. Steve Ditko, what? What? It was Bat and Lash, and this was his number one artist that he admired and copied among the other ones.
World's biggest fan.
He said, I've never even met a woman who knew who Steve Ditko was. So he and his friends were going to be coming to San Diego 3 weeks after that. So I found excuses to call him during those 3 weeks saying, since you're coming to San Diego, there's Toys Your Chocolatier is in Manhattan. If you by any chance can get there and, you know, bring me some of the toffee things that I really like. And then I'm having a barbecue at my house on a Tuesday night. So if you want to come for that. And so he and his friends came to the barbecue. And then when everybody was leaving, I said, well, if you want to stick around a little longer, I'll show you my Ditko originals. And I had a 5-page story from Journey into Mystery that he had done, you know, and like he just wanted to stay there and stare at the artwork and not leave. Long story short, we ended up getting married, publishing his comics, Wolfenberg Counselors of the Macabre, and then the thrill of his lifetime was when Jim Salicrup asked him to do a backup story in Satan 6. And Satan 6 was, the lead story was a Jack Kirby story. And so he said, I want to do like the old time Marvel comics where there's a like 3 or 4 page backup story and you could do it in a Ditko style. And that's it, you bet. So he purposely did hands and all the stuff and he did a very Ditko-esque backup story that with his characters, Wolf and Bird. And then Jim Salicrup calls him up and said, would you mind if Steve Ditko inked the story? What? Mine? So Ditko inked the story, and then he said, you know, normally we split things up, but I'm just going to let you have all the original art on that. And when he got that art in the mail, he studied every ink line. He said, oh, why didn't I do it that way? He made it so much better. So this was the thrill of his life to have had his hero ink his work. And that was just a fabulous interaction. So,
woo. Oh, that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing, all three of you. I would love to go to an audience question if somebody wants to come up to that mic. All right.
Mark, I met you at San Diego Comic Fest a few years ago, and I asked you a question. I'll ask the same question now. A lot of us probably in this room have followed the Kirby saga where his family was pursuing kind of economic justice. And they finally, after many, many years, won it. And there was a pending Supreme Court ruling that that never happened. So what I asked you then is, I think every Ditko person on earth, a Ditko fan, would think it would be economic justice for the estate and the family to kind of get something like a settlement like Kirby's family got. And is there any thing you can mention about that, or
no comment?
No, really, I can't say anything about that right now.
Well,
unfortunately, Jackie can say whatever she wants.
What was I was paid as work for hire to work on this stuff. So I'm not out to go after Marvel for that kind of thing, because it was our contract that was legal. And so everybody was encouraging, well, yeah, but, you know, look at how much Spider-Man is everywhere now. And it was interesting, one time Bat and I were in New York walking down the street, and the Spider-Man movie was on the marquee, and Bat said, see that building there? See the fourth floor? That's where Steve's studio was. So right looking down on the marquee for the Spider-Man movie. And but that was my understanding of his just integrity of him honoring the legal, what he saw as the legal situation.
I think from some quote that I remember reading, that there was something about him, between him and Goodman, specifically maybe as a person-to-person issue. I do remember that coming up, but that's the only thing I remember about that.
One thing I would like to say, in general, one of the reasons why some of the stuff that me and Alex do, and what I'm glad to see everybody here, this is great, is that we have to keep Steve Ditko's name alive, and we have to keep remembering him, because we have to keep saying his name. You know, one of the reasons I really loved, I wrote the play, when I wrote my play, I said, well, you know, Steve will probably hate it. He will hate it. Which is why I waited till after he passed to actually put it on. And what is one of the things is, though, if we're not saying Steve Ditko's name and remembering him, having panels, writing books, writing plays, talking about him, having discussions about him, then 10, 15 years, you know, it's, His name might just, you know, kind of dissipate a little bit more. You might not see it. And that would be very sad. We have to keep saying Steve Ditko's name no matter what.
Yeah,
absolutely. Right.
Let me just kind of cap that with just one statement is, he had a bit of a relationship with a guy named Russ Maharis. And Russ was a military person that was in PR. And they wrote back quite extensively. In fact, I think his letters went on Heritage Auction, you know, last year or the year before. So Russ always had these discussions with him about clarifying things and making things right, you know, getting the truth out there in terms of his contributions. And I think at some point my uncle had kind of just let that go. But he wrote Russ, and one thing he said was, in the letter he said, thanks for the article and the willingness to clear up the avoided and evaded. So it wasn't that he didn't want justice. I think at some point he just decided he had to move on. And I have other letters and things that he had written that he had just moved on, and he had that ability to do that. So we'll see what happens.
And he had the outlet through Robin Snyder to set the record straight on, you know, lots of things that were in the newsletter. So those were really fascinating things to read from him of what, you know, the real situations that happened in the creative process back at Marvel and everything.
Absolutely. Thank you. Next question.
Yes. Steve, of course, was a huge artistic talent, both art-wise and writing-wise, and had very distinctive style and nature to that. And his, from what my understanding is, his upbringing, whereas a lot of those guys seem to have grown up in these urban, gritty environments, Hell's Kitchen and places like that, Steve grew up in, it sounds like, my understanding, a different environment. And I'm curious, for those who are very familiar with a lot of the oeuvre of the comics world, how do you see how his upbringing made his writing and artistic style different than that of his contemporaries?
One answer that I would have is his background from Slovakian parents, basically, you know, Eastern European. So there's a book that Zach Cruz, who wrote this book, Mysterious Traveler, he refers to a book, I think it's called, and I was looking for it real quick if I couldn't find it, With Bread and Butter, The History of the Johnstown Immigrants from the 1800s. And it's about their attitudes. And one of the things that from their perspective, education actually wasn't even the highest tier emphasis. It was work ethic. It was putting your head down and working. So he was born and raised with a very, very high work ethic. So I think for one, and that sort of, I see that translate into sort of the Ditko gene in a way. We could very easily be workaholics, but we love what we do. So that's the other thing. So one, I think his upbringing sort of primed him to be the best and a professional at what he did. And then the next level, I think, which was the other piece of that puzzle, is he was extremely intelligent. Like, he was so learned. I mean, I have his library, and we're cataloging that. Zach is cataloging that now with all his notations in there. His library is massive, and he was so well-read. So he was very educated. So I think that combined with his just creative skill, his imagination, you know. So you take a very, very good, you know, he was one of the Olympians. You know, he was an Olympic artist, creator, like Jack Kirby and Wally Wood and all those guys that did that. So he was just of that caliber. It was a combination of his background, his upbringing, generationally, and then just his ability to put it all together.
And one example, for instance, is that Comic-Con gave him the Eisner Hall of Fame, and he said, you know, thanks, but no thanks. I don't need awards. I'm not here to get accolades, attention, et cetera. I'm here because I love what I'm doing, and I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. And, you know, people like it, fine. If they don't, that doesn't mean I'm not going to keep doing it. So he wasn't one of those people that would be out there whining, nobody's paying attention to my stuff. You know, that he was just, if they do, fine. But it's my thing, and I get to do it. And that's, what more could you want?
In fact, to add to that, he said in a letter that he wrote in 1991, past achievements can be a trap if one believes he can live on what he did yesterday or last month, new yesterday, etc. Past achievements can become excess baggage. So he was forward thinking. That's why he was able to just let things go and move forward.
Yeah, I think something that surprises a lot of fans is that his life didn't depend on Spider-Man. No. And I think so many fans get surprised and they almost don't know how to interpret it seems. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like, especially hanging out with you and your family at Ditko Con and mm-hmm. talking in our conversations, is it was more about a job well done, applying it, learning from what he did in one experimental art piece, and then applying that to the next, constantly improving. And that's kind of an engineer that makes a machine, now wants to build a better machine next time.
One thing I would like to say, has anyone been to Johnstown? Anyone here? All right, nice. really great. There is another DickoCon coming out in late September, so look at that. But one of the things I will say, this from an outsider looking in, when they did the first DickoCon, when they did it in 2021, myself and my family, you know, Like I said before, I didn't know, a lot of us didn't know, even as far back as 10 years ago, that there were other Dickos besides Steve Ditko, because he never said anything. So when I had the invitation to DickoCon, I was going down to Johnstown and driving down. We get to the Bottle Works. If you haven't looked at the Bottle Works, make sure you do. They're doing great work there. Very Steve Ditko oriented. Unbelievable place. And there's two murals up there too. And there's going to be a third one soon. We went in there and there was a reception. And the only person I knew of all the Dickos was Mark, I think, was at that point. And I went in, and I didn't see Mark, but I saw Dickos as far as the eye can see. So I was like crashing a wedding or a bar mitzvah, and I'm like, oh, am I turned completely white? And I'm like, oh, no, what do I do? And they all said, you're the playwright. And I'm like, oh, gosh. And they all welcomed me, even though I felt like I was crashing the party. They all welcomed me. They all had a work ethic. But they all welcomed me, which it was a place that, you know, I couldn't believe. And at that point, I'm like, wow, this is amazing. I think his aunts actually hit on me. And I kept telling them I'm not available. But they persisted because discos are persistent. One of the things, like, this is my wife. And they're like, yeah. Anyway. but it was really wonderful. You can tell there was a work ethic. But I can also say this, very, very much so, and I say this, and I think Alex, you've been, right?
Oh, yeah.
You go there, and it's a place filled with love. And one thing we don't talk about, and even though I do believe that all the Dickos I've met have that work ethic, from an outsider looking in, there is a community in Johnstown of love. And if you haven't been to Johnstown, it feels very much like some place that Steve Ditko would come from. And it's even the buildings, I think your father has designed a few, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
You feel like the buildings are like Ditko. So I say, you know, what, you know, the Ditko-esque, it's amazing. So after you leave San Diego, go hop in your cars and go to Johnstown. and that's from an outsider looking in, it was truly incredible. And it is incredible if you go there.
Yeah, something I noticed about the Ditkos, they're all different from each other. They're not clones of Steve Ditko or anything. But nope. that'd be another clone saga, actually. At any rate, but one thing that is pretty similar among all of them is they're not the type that, like, brag. Mm-hmm. Like bragging isn't something that even there's an impulse, it seems. They're just kind of their own person, and they enjoy each other, and they enjoy people talking to them, and it's great. It's eye-opening. It's a wonderful experience.
And if I may add to that as well, you know, one interesting thing is, and Mark, I don't know if you feel this when you go back home too, but, you know, a lot of the community back home in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, I think a lot of them really weren't aware that that's where the co-creator of Spider-Man was from. You know, so it's kind of, you know, just it's very, he was very humble and very, you know, like you said, Alex, never would anybody brag about it. And I mean, it's nice to know, but I think it's just that community and the Eastern European, you know, roots, you know, you just work hard and, you know, you
do the best you can.
Do the best you can.
Yeah,
absolutely. So it's nice.
Okay. So first of all, thank you for holding the session, because this was the one session I was not going to miss in Comic-Con. Honestly, I love Steve Ditko's art, and it's so hard to find anything about his life. You know, I've been getting every book I can. I notice now that there's many I missed. I'm trying to answer. So my question would be, what can you share about, like, his really personal things? And I know you probably don't want to, but, like, maybe some of his political views, his worldviews. What did he think about the world? And because it's so hard to find anything, at least I haven't found it.
Well, okay, I'll say a couple things. First of all, I think you have to, right now, we don't have anything published out there. It's coming. So really all that you have now are things that are done by somebody else. Like, so Zach Cruz, this mysterious traveler, this, from an outsider perspective, Zach's, he paints a philosophical portrait of him through his whole artwork. So this, I'll say, is, you know, and a lot of people have given me the books to edit or comment on, and I generally do, like when he's play.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a story. This one, I had literally not a single comment, because it was just beautiful, just the way it was. So this is one thing. Another one is this book. So there's, you know, Bernie's stories in there, again, are very revealing of who he was. And then this one by David Curry, Ditko Shrug, is another one.
In Search of Steve Ditko.
In Search of Steve Ditko is kind of another aspect of that. Now, I'll say what I'm primarily interested in right now. So we have a family book that's kind of in the works, from family and friends stories. So that's probably really what you're after. But to me, there's another avenue that I'm trying to accelerate right now, even after this con, is his essays. So in his essays, he really describes himself. So if you have it, and there have been published through Robin Snyder, you know, some of them are just very hard to find. In fact, I'm still trying to locate just the 4 or 5 that I don't have. Otherwise, I have hundreds of his essays. And he, in those, I'll tell you what, if you read the, okay, his artwork is his artwork. It communicates what he wants through his artwork. But his essays are him. That's actually his voice and what he feels about politics and personal things and stuff. I mean, that's really where you get a strong sense of who he was. In fact, I was telling Marcy just last night, you know, even if I don't get this published immediately, I'm going to prepare, I'm going to create these books and give them to all the family, just so that the family understands that side of him that maybe he didn't reveal, you know, the deeper side of him. So I think right now, you know, these books is unfortunately all that we really have, or the, all that someone has from the outside. But I think the next thing coming up that I would really say is you have to just read what he wrote. Just have to read what he wrote.
And the thing is, you have to realize that he studied philosophy. He studied logic.
Everything.
He studied history. He was a staunch individualist, and everything... Individualism started as the basis of everything else.
Yeah.
Aristotle's, where you get Mr. A from, A is A, that's Aristotle. So, I mean, he studied aesthetics, ethics.
Criminality, you go on.
All of
on
the yeah. different areas of philosophy. And so it wasn't just random stuff that he got from different places and mushed together. It was very systematic. Coming up with a worldview that fit together. And yes, you know, he was an objectivist, he was a student of objectivism, and so he got a lot of his reading from seeing the reading list for that. But still, it's just based in pretty much what America's based on, and freedom and liberty, number one, along with individualism. So
I mean, I have a lot of letters and quotes and things from him that could kind of expand on that, but I've try to kind of focus this, but Zach Cruz is right now cataloging his library. Again, that is going to be very revealing. What did he read? You know, so I'd say that's the answer that I can give you. Best answer I can give you now.
Thank you so much.
Sorry, if I may, I can check. To answer your question, read what is it that disturbs you, Stephen? Dr. Strange, right? That's so much of his philosophy, and that is existentialism. His cosmic beliefs, his belief in God or the higher power, right? So, sorry. real quick, I was very fortunate to meet Mr. Ditko. My uncle is Bob Chapman, graffiti designs, small book. But he went to one of his dead dog parties. And he sat right next to me, not a drinker, but sat down with a glass of beer, saw I was drinking a glass of whiskey, and he said, "What are you drinking, kid?" "Whiskey." "All right, I'll have one too." And we had that same discussion, ma'am. It was, I gushed about him with Spider-Man, I gushed about him with Dr. Strange. We talked a little bit about like what he thought about the movies and what he thought about Benedict Cumberbatch playing him, and he loved that. He loved Cumberbatch more than the Spider-Man film. But that's what we talked about, what guys talked about, other than babes and sports in a bar. We talked about philosophy and sophism and his belief in the Greeks and Aristotle and stuff like that. So whoever the guy was that asked the question, I'm a philosophy major. I know I look like a punk, but I'm a philosophy major. And he sat down and he schooled me. I sat there, and I don't know if you've ever been to a graffiti design party. Bob has the butcher paper with crayons. I sat there and I ended up taking notes. I'm like, Ditko thinks this. Underline, circle, circle. So I gotta say, I've been a college parent, I'm 52 years old, I've been doing this for most of my adult life. I'm getting goosebumps just now. The highlight of my life was talking to that man for half hour, maybe.
I appreciate you so much. I'm so sorry to cut you off. I'm so sorry. Yeah. No, it's fine, but we really appreciate what you have to say. Thank you so much. We do have one more person who has a question, but thank you.
I think this has already been asked, but I'll say it a different way. That I hadn't heard of Steve Ditko until I read a Mr. A that was at Wit's End, and I came out of it going, what? So I'm going to ask the same question. What?
Well, you know,
A
what?
Is A.
Yeah, I'll say this is he wrote to me multiple times about his what characters, and I'm trying to find quickly here. Oh, he said regarding Mr. A, he said that is one character from the past that I would like to see in the present and in the future. So it was really, Mr. A was just his baby. And, you know, you really kind of have to, I'll say, read that, say, with a grain of salt, because in my opinion, this is my, and you really just have to read it. You have to read it and you take it, take away whatever you take away. But he always believed, and again, I can't find the quotes, but he always believed that that comics should have evolved. Should have evolved from a pure, and look, we already know that they've evolved from a market of a small child to more adults. You know, comics have had this evolution. But he always thought it should have taken a step further than that and become more of a channel for education and conveyance of truth. So Mr. A was kind of his baby of being, I'll say it in my words because they're not his, being very dramatic about choices that we have to make in being right or wrong. So he had this philosophy of things are black or things are white. And in what's just Aristotelian, you know, that's really what that is. There is right and there is wrong.
There is no gray.
You know? And to me, there is a line in some topics. There is a point where there are just clear decisions to do or not to do. Thou shalt not kill. You know, you don't go out and kill someone. Don't do that. That's a bad thing. So, and I think Mr. A was just sort of his embodiment of that to try to say, look, think about what you're doing. Just think about it. If anything, just think about it. Yeah. Conscience. Yeah. So anyway, that's my
It was also
grasp of
the role of emotion should not affect your decision.
Yeah, right.
You have to be logical.
Yeah.
If you let emotion run your life, then you're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, agreed.
How much of that, Mark, Marcy, or Jackie, do you think is a reaction to living in New York?
In my opinion, none. I mean, that came out of his life experience and the message that he wanted to convey. I think he was very disillusioned by certain aspects of the world decline. And even in the past, he was obviously a historian. He studied history. And I think the fact that he really just looked and embraced so much and just realized that there were instances of where man was not at his best. And then I think he just gravitated towards, well, what is man at his best? And then just really went to solve that.
I found it very interesting as his career, you know, came through the 70s and the 80s, you do see him actually trying to push the art form forward in many instances. I forget what it was almost like a 100-page story he did, but it was almost a precursor to graphic novels. And it really, if you look at what he's doing, he's really pushing the form as he grows and as we grow. I personally would have loved to have seen, and this is just something else, his ideas for what Spider-Man should have done, and actually had it been, honestly.
Yeah, really.
And honestly, my personal thing, I can't actually, I have a problem getting past the first 38 issues. I love the first 38 issues, but then it turns. And I think Romita is a great artist, very romantic, all those things. But you look at those first 38 issues and you look at Doctor Strange and they're their own thing. And honestly, those are the things that everything's based off of. There's nothing else that really goes beyond that, besides Venom maybe, you know, in those movies and a couple other things. But you look at those, everything kind of like stems from that. So I would love to have seen where would have gone and like, you know.
Well, you know what, let me cut you off there because there's just, and I know we have some questions and I just if Alex could just do this like in an encapsulated way. To me, the evolution of where Spider-Man have gone was at Charlton.
Yeah, absolutely.
Know? So to me, I
thought that was Blue Beetle.
Yeah, exactly.
And becoming a mature individual, growing out of the neuroticism that was part of that Marvel style was to become a more perfect individual and to apply that to the world around you. So I think Blue Beetle is Spider-Man Part 2, basically.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, what's funny is the Doctor Strange stuff, it's so psychedelic. Yeah. So all the hippies and everything was like, oh, yeah, he's with us. He's doing the drugs. Yeah, out there. And, you know, as far as I know, Steve was
not straight
somebody
white.
That ever took it.
No.
Right. And this will be the last question.
Okay. All right.
let's see, I became really passionate about disco, Ditko when I was like collecting him, and actually I was dyslexic and kind of learned how to read by reading Ditko and being excited about it. And you guys have talked a lot about how he sees worlds in black and white, but as a 12-year-old, I really was moved by his compassion for Peter Parker, for Dr. Strange, these people that are marginalized. And I wonder what in his background kind of informed that, let him talk about that, and, you know, really influenced my life, because I felt a lot more like, yeah, I could kind of find my way back into something productive myself.
I think part of it is that he did stuff that you could apply to your own life in whatever way it hit you. So that's something that you connected with, but there's other things that other people got out of it that would be, wow, you got that out of it? So, you know, that's the great thing about it, is there's so much there to extract your own interpretations and influences. And, you know, for some people, it's just entertainment, you know, enjoy it. But other people's like, whoa, all right.
I think his character was, you know, like very relatable, as you said. You know, I mean, I know when I would, you know, read the books or even the movie, it's like, this is like a real person. This is like real life. I can relate to that, you know. I have brothers who had gone through different things, and, you know, it's just, it's a like a normal people. And I think a lot of that comes from, you know, from where we're from. You know, it's like, it's just, it's very, I don't know, it's just a very different, you know, going from Johnstown and then him moving to New York City, very drastic change too.
But you know what, Marcy maybe said it in a conversation we had, is that we would just want to show that he was human. I can go on and on and on in answer to your question, just kind of showing, and I would say this is his experience with Bernie, you know, in New York when Bernie was a small child and his father passed away, and he was just, my uncle was there for him. You know, so there was a humanity that he had that most people are really unaware of. So, and I think that comes out in his writing, especially his early stuff. So, I mean, I think that's an aspect of him. And although, I mean, he was a storyteller, but, you know, he's drawing on everything around him in his entire world, from what he's studied, what he's experienced, what other people have experienced, what if, you know, there's all that is fodder, you know, for his imagination and for what he wanted to do. So obviously that comes out. You know,
and I think if you look at, you know, the origins of Peter Parker and everything, where I don't know how much it was Stan, how much it was Steve, but here's this guy, I got superpowers, I'm going to monetize that. I'm going to put that, you know, I'm going to, you know, make money off of having these things. And then he realizes, but wait, I should be doing good things with these abilities that I, you know, didn't ask for and now suddenly have. So I think that was a thing that affected a lot of readers and made them big fans of Spider-Man.
Right.
And you had this alter ego that, you know, just had to make moral decisions and realized, okay, I got to do the right thing.
I mean, that's a really good question. I wish I could actually go into that a lot deeper.
Yeah.
And I wish we had the time.
Yeah. I think it also relates to everybody here, too. I mean, for me, the part where Peter Parker's crying, his Uncle Ben died, that's the most iconic panel for me. And it affects us. It affects, like, with great power comes great responsibility. Sure, but Steve was part of that, and it was part of everyone's life, basically. It's actually where I learned morality in a lot of regards.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your question. And thank you guys so much for being here today. I do, before we start doing our plugs and everybody says where they can find any new, any more information or anything else about you guys, I would also like to ask just a really, really quick question real quick, because again, he has impacted all of us, I believe, in this room. I would just like to know a quote, your favorite quote of him, either something written down or said, or a really quick fact that you guys have learned from doing research, just real quick, just down the line. And, before we end this,
I think for me, it's that
I always kind of work on the next project and the next project. And something that I kind of resonate with the Ditkos on and Steve's history is when it's finished, then I go to the next one and I try to apply what I learned from that to the next, and I try to build on each project. And I think there's something about studying Steve Ditko's life and looking at all that, and there's something in that that I try to mirror in my day-to-day life.
Absolutely. That's awesome.
That's kind of where I'm at too, work ethic. Because work ethic and actually putting in the best quality you can do with what you're doing. And then when you finish that, don't look back. Go forward to the next one and give that project the work ethic that it deserves. Everything, give it the time and attention it deserves, and doing it right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say my closing statement is on him is that everyone or anyone that has seen pictures of him from the 60s, there were those few pictures in him at his desk. He had that word think, you know, on his light. So he sat there in those early days with think, you know, basically just like use your head. And whatever that meant to him, that, you know, whether it was think, just be thoughtful, be investigative, or whatever that really meant to him, but it was basically process. So when we went to clean out his studio, he had a different message on his desk, and it was never give up. So, you know, over the years, I think that to me and different stories that I've had with others and things that they've relayed to me is that he was, he could be a very, very, and was a very, very strong supporter of people. So I think early on, you know, his message was he was young, he was, you know, moving, creating. But towards the end there, I don't know when that message appeared there, but it was never give up. So it's basically go after your dreams, do it.
Yeah. And for me, it's just, you know, I feel the passion from him, from his, what he had done for a living, because he had the passion for the art. And he spoke his mind, and he said what he wanted. I think one thing that Mark and I had talked about as well, and one thing that I just wanted to mention, you know, in he didn't do a lot of interviews, and you don't see a lot of photos. And sometimes when you don't see that, when you don't hear the words from his mouth, people tend to make up their own story. And I think one of the things that we wanted to get across today was that, I mean, he was just a wonderful person, beautiful soul, very giving, very talented, obviously, and had a passion for the art. It wasn't about money. It was about doing what he loved to do.
And he loved it.
He absolutely loved it. So, and thank you all, too, for this. This is beautiful, and I'm going to take this back to my family that, wow, I can't believe all these people here. Yeah, it gives me chills. So thank you.
Absolutely.
I would say be an individual. Don't worry about what anybody else thinks. That you don't have to have anybody looking over your shoulder. Just do your own thing. And if you are true to what your interests are, what your abilities are, then you're going to attract people with that same ideology, and you'll have support from that. And whether you want it or not, there's going to be people who think that you're the best comics creator ever in the history of the world.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much. And thank you, Lenny. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Marcy. Thank you so much, Jackie.
Hey, shout out to Ivan Briggs at PBA Auctions. He's having an auction.